I'm Ash Evans from Telefry, and it's my pleasure to present Bevan Dam, who will today be talking about medical rates benchmarking. He's a director in the financial services group at EY. He's a qualified actuary and has worked in the insurance industry for almost a decade in both injury schemes and health insurance, currently holding an appointed actuary role. So, with medical rates benchmarking, here's Bevan Dam.
Thank you. All right. First after lunch on the second day. So we had three presenter names on here. I'm the only presenter today. Foo's on his shortly going to be on his way to the UK to work for an insurer in one of the new high data type areas, and Jennifer's not up here for the conference at the moment. So what I might touch on is the agenda. So what I'll go through is the context about why I wanted to do this paper, and then a bit of it, which provides the motivation really and curiosity from my point of view. Talk a bit about the method, how we went about it, some of the results from the benchmarking. It's quite a formidable kind of task when you try and take it on. And then a little bit about how we aggregated up some of the results. So I'll talk about that, and it's only partial results because of all the problems when you try and do this exercise across the schemes, which we'll touch on a bit. And then the second half really is around the so what. Why would you do it? Why can't you do it? What's the advantage of bringing together the rates across schemes or across the country? So the context, really having a look at the national view of the medical expenditure, where do schemes fit in the picture? And I flick over to this diagram here, you've probably seen this, Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. It's a fairly well-known picture of the funding of health. We have the black areas, so we've got federal funding, state funding, individuals, private health insurers, and then we have the schemes. What's also not on here is there's a couple of new pieces that aren't on here. One is the new federal money under the reforms that's flowing through the states and into that funding basis. There's a reason I talk about that is because that's a potential model that the schemes can adopt. And there's also the schemes are actually refunding back to the health insurers where your claimants are actually using health insurers in the first instance. So there's a few things that aren't actually on that diagram. But if I come back, around the regulated schemes, there's regulated costs, and it does vary by scheme. So typically the schemes are self-regulated. They're written. The state legislation pretty much means that they can do what they want across or within the jurisdiction themselves, so it does vary by scheme. And if we compare it to the private funders, so the hospitals are held to quite tight contracts within the private health schemes arrangement, for example, but doctors actually are the least controlled, and they're actually the hardest ones, kind of the one that no one's worked out how to control doctors yet. And I mean doctors, for example, GPs and medical specialists. And if we look at allied health, it's actually a mix of funding and a mix of success in setting rate schedules. So for me, 2009-10, we did some work with WorkCover New South Wales using service level data. And having worked in private health insurance, I guess I was used to very, very granular data and looking in detail about the services and when and what happened and the combination of services. So when I started looking at scheme data, I was, first of all, I was kind of amused that they didn't collect it, but of course New South Wales WorkCover was collecting it by then, which was really quite useful. So we were able to actually see, and we wrote a previous paper on the claim management efficiencies that was actually based partly around their detailed and granular data around the medical schedules and payments. So in 2012 we also got another look across a couple of different schemes where we were asked to do comparisons between schemes in quite a lot of detail. So this paper is only using publicly available information. While we have knowledge of other things that aren't public, we've made sure that everything in this is based on publicly available information. And then if we look at payment systems, so the national system of health payments, so that's what I referred to before, that gives us a picture about the context. And what that's doing is driving nationally efficient pricing across states that federal government is trying to drive. So really it's there for the schemes to also look at and maybe start to think about, is that a way that they can also control costs? So from a medical perspective, you've got the price part of it and you've got the utilisation. Well, this is really just focused on the price component of the medical payments. So our method for the benchmarking, we looked at a variety of payment types, so GPs, medical specialists, allied health, hospitals, public and private. That pretty much makes up the broader spectrum of what's out there and the schemes are paying for. The benchmark schemes and systems, so we looked at, as I said, the public information. We interviewed some schemes where the information was a bit harder to get hold, but it was still made readily available through the public means. We looked at private health insurance data, some public, some accessible to the insurers but not necessarily fully public. And we also looked at Independent Hospital Pricing Authority, who've developed a model, and that's the underpinning of another method for setting prices. Scheme types, obviously, both types of schemes, and selective services, so pretty much there's thousands of different price points across the schemes, and so we ranked them, we looked at where the expenditure was, ranked them and picked the ones that were probably best representative but also very large in the volume of payments to focus on the most. There is also an issue around availability of useful data, and we'll see that come out in some of the results. I might add, we probably bit off more than we could chew, and we were overly ambitious when we did start this, in thinking that we'd actually get a full and comprehensive type of result out of it. While not disappointing that we haven't, what it does indicate is, gee, there's a lot of work out there to be done within the schemes around this, if they so choose. Obviously, they don't necessarily need to, and there's good reasons why you may not, and I'll cover some of those as well. So, I can't really walk away from here, so I'll have to talk to it. So you'll see a couple of slides that look very similar to this. This is the fee schedule benchmarks across a range of schemes. So the schemes across the x-axis, they're taken off so that even though it's public information, I guess just want to focus on the variation, not necessarily who and the what. And what we have is the price scale for the fees on the left-hand side. And for this one in particular, this is around private hospital theatre fees, and they have a range of bands that are quite commonly used across the schemes, and so we listed some of those bands. So I guess the first interesting result when you look at this, it's a relatively simple exercise, but the first thing you see is that some of the bands are actually flipped in their fee schedules, and so you kind of go, well, what's going on there? They don't always have answers to those when you do ask the schemes about why they've set their schedules up like that. Generally, you'll see consistency, but quite often you'll see quite stark inconsistency. So if we move on to the next one. So this is bed day rates for private hospital overnight. So what that means is per day, that's a base fee, and then there's things added on to that. And what you can see is the three different colours are based on whether you're a surgical and advanced surgical, which should be more expensive or more complex type of procedures, or rehab, which is kind of you're at the back end and there's other things that are occurring and you're trying to exercise those hips to get them fixed and working again after your surgery. So there's a few things that stand out. First of all, if you look on the moving from the left to the right, the first one is typically ranked where I might expect it, although rehab, it's kind of, that could be anywhere, but if you're looking at overnight accommodation, pretty much there's consistency, there's the nursing staff, etc., and there's a reasonably predictable cost. If you look at the next two, what you see is rehab's far more expensive. So what they've probably done in their fee schedule, although not always guaranteed, is they've built in some additional services and agreements with those hospitals, although it's really through the health space, or from a private hospital perspective, they might have an agreement with all the hospitals around what kind of services they'll include for that fee. And then if we look at the ones on the right, you can see, well, they're a fair bit cheaper. Yeah, they're a different geography. Is that really leading to the cost differential? So what you might ask is, well, the total cost of visiting the hospital if you're a surgical patient and you've been in for 10 days, so what you might do is divide this number by 10 and add it to that number, and that kind of gives you a benchmark. The reason I haven't put the private health space on here around an average bed day is it comes in at a higher rate. So clearly the fee schedules that the schemes are doing is rather interesting, but it's also there's other elements that need to be added onto it. If we look at GPs, so what we have here is there's two kinds of services that are most common. One is you go and visit them for a short period, 5 to 15 minutes, and one is you visit for a bit longer, you know, 30 minutes, 45 minutes. And so they roughly have two base fees that they're charging on that basis. And then there's Medicare benefit schedule, which gives you a guide about what the government thinks is worthwhile price. There's AMA, Australian Medical Association price, which is essentially usually twice the MBS rate. And that's a price that's kind of put out by the association as a reasonable price to be the doctors should be charging for their fees for those appropriate item numbers. So what you see here is I have a dark number, which is the AMA limit, and the light colour is the MBS item for the standard and the extended. So you can see the standard fees, they're all roughly sitting on that middle grey line, which is the AMA rate for a standard visit. There's two that are significantly lower. So one jurisdiction's clearly, well, they might not have negotiated. They've said that's all they're willing to pay. So you've got to ask, well, is there an advantage in that? Are they getting better value, or are they actually missing out on some service that they could be getting? The second part is to look at the ratios between the red and the blue dots. And what you see is different jurisdictions have different ratios for the short and long visits. So what you might think is when someone initially visits a GP, if they've been injured in your schemes, first visits should probably be a bit of a comprehensive one to work out what's going on, work out a plan, try and get on top of it early. So maybe you'd want to be paying a bit more for the extended and then work out what about the short ones and what prices should they be at. What we see here also is, if we go back to here, there's nothing on the right-hand side of the diagram. We see some turning up on the right-hand side of the diagram. So there's more schemes that actually have set federal schedule rates for GPs. If we look at surgery, we see material differences between schemes again. Are they getting the same thing? Well, most likely they are. Again, the dark line is the AMA rate that the AMA thinks is a reasonable price to be charged for this. So two schemes have agreed that a price that's significantly higher than the AMA rate, and all the others are mostly around that. But also, schemes to the left of the diagram, there's less of them than there were before. So that's another, obviously some schemes pick and choose about what they want to tie rates to. Because if you're not doing this, you're basically paying the market rate. Well, market rate might actually be a reasonable way of doing it. This specific orthopaedic surgery, so this for a knee surgery, we see similar pattern to the wound. The number on the left, materially higher. So it's obviously a far more complex operation. But here you actually see some of the fees are below the AMA, and there's one that's materially above the AMA rates. So again, what's the motivation behind the different rates across schemes, which is certainly not clear when you're doing a benchmarking perspective. And then, so this is the only allied health one that I'll put up. Physiotherapy, it's pretty much the most common across all schemes that gets used. And what I've put in there is the average fee that private health insurers, they don't pay. That's the average fee that someone who visits a physio and then claims it to their health insurer, that's the fee that they paid. There might be an out-of-pocket. But what it gives is an indication of what the actual market price is for a standard visit to a physiotherapist. And we see that most schemes are actually willing to pay that, so they've actually set the rate close to that. One scheme is paying above that. For the extended, obviously, that's a different situation. And so some schemes are willing to allow more of that, but then I guess the question comes to the efficacy of doing physio visits and, you know, over 10-week periods and things like that. And again, what we see is similar to the previous ones. We see one state tends to always be underpricing, which is quite clear that there's an intent going on within that jurisdiction. So if we summarise, if we try and bring that together in a bit of a weighted approach, what does that mean if we say, well, let's set some benchmarks in different places and make it all more or less level? Now, there might be reasons why you can't do that, and I'll explore some of those. But if you do that, what are the potential savings? Well, there's one that stands out that says the one we saw where it was typically lower than average for each of those service types. What we're suggesting there is if we applied a national kind of benchmark, they would actually be paying more. But all the other jurisdictions would actually be paying less, some materially. And if we roll that up, there's potentially a 12% saving. So where did I suggest, and this is a little bit arbitrary, but if you look at what the market pricing says, it's probably not too far off the money. GPs and specialists may be at 150% of the Medicare benefit schedule rate, as an example, and as you move that up and down, then those savings may be more or less. Physios running at average, but that was fairly clear. That's probably a reasonable approach. And with the hospital surgery, if we chose what was the minimum across the jurisdictions, because clearly with private hospital, it's actually the same hospital group that operates nationally, so they can see all the different contracts they have around the country with all the schemes, with all the health insurers, and so it's really to their advantage, and they work out pretty well where they can exploit more or less the people who are paying them. So if you chose the least one, so rolling that all up, there's potentially 12% to be saved through that process if you did it nationally. How you might roll that into other benefit types, other fees that aren't currently listed, other fees that are listed, that 12% may vary. It might be between 8, might be as high as 15. So this is really, I guess, initial research. There are many, many holes in doing it, and we can see that results, well, there's certainly quite a few jurisdictions that I wasn't willing to put up results because it's just it's not clear enough, not willing to do that enough, whereas these ones, there's a little bit of certainty in the numbers that are sitting under it. So, just checking time, okay. If we look at, well, why would you do this? Well, why not? So the national payment structure, if you have a national payment structure, so that promotes mobility of service providers, but really, do they really need that? Or what about if, from your perspective, a single point of negotiation, or does that create additional bureaucracy somewhere? And are you going to pay for it? Or are you already replicating that across each of the schemes at the moment? What about being even-handed and providing certain payment levels across schemes for providers? So that tends to be a bit of a frustration that some providers don't like operating with certain schemes, and I'll touch on an example of that. What about setting the upper limits for payments from a scheme perspective? So there's certainly advantage in that, and I guess that's where we kind of start, isn't it? We think, oh, well, wouldn't we be trying to set some upper limit? That way we can control cost of claims. Well, how much of claims is this? Well, how much of the liability is this affecting? How much of the cash flows is this actually affecting? Or is the behaviour around medical, are there other advantages to being a bit smarter and maybe paying a little bit more but asking for really specific things that affect and drive scheme outcomes? So if we look at what might we harmonise, so what might we make equal across schemes, and why not all the rates? So medical rates, they've already got a structural basis that they operate from, so Medicare Benefits Schedule and AMA. There's a lot of commonality that occurs, and that actually occurs across schemes. But what we see is that the schemes aren't all adopting that kind of approach. Some schemes adopt different approaches. What about allied health? It certainly has the least structured from a government perspective. Maybe it's not about trying to limit that. Maybe it's about there's a fair bit of volume there that's occurring, and the government tends not to regulate the, for example, physios compared to the medical fraternity. Hospitals, they already have several existing approaches available also. So what we've got day rates that can be charged, we've got activity-based funding model that can be used, we've got independent pricing as well by specific schemes. So that's because different schemes have different severity mixes compared to the general public, and so different schemes may look for a different funding basis so that it better matches the kind of severities they've got within their scheme. So typically CDP is a heavier user of more severe public hospital type or acute usage than workers' comp, as an example. If we look at some of the impediments to doing that, what we have is the variance across cost bases and within jurisdictions. Is that a fair approach? Or if we let market set prices, is that a fair approach to the providers? So really what we're expecting is that they're setting a cost base to them doing business, and then they need a bit of profit. And so what we actually see is when they want more business, then they'll put their prices down a little bit, whereas when there's a fee structure, it's a little bit of economic restriction there, I suppose, could say. And one other point to do with medical is around the MBS rates. So the Medicare Benefit Schedule, it's pretty much a marginal cost of doing business with a bit shaved, so the federal government's actually really restricted the inflation in that over time. So maybe the schemes, certainly the doctors wouldn't want to be tied too much to that, but maybe the schemes can look at a method of using that, but a bit smarter and using that as an indexing approach. So if I look at leakage in the context of specifically the rates that we're talking about, it's, you know, an overpayment that could have been prevented or an ultimate settlement cost that could have been lower ultimately. So the things I've seen, I guess, around the medical benefits leakages is paying more than the schedule rates, and we've certainly seen that across the schemes we've looked at over the last 4 years now. It continues to occur. And also what we see is poor behaviour from service providers. So there's over-servicing and multiple billing. The multiple billing, though, is a funny thing because it, even though it's pretty much under control, it historically came about because invoices weren't being paid. So the medical provider would rebill after a period and then do it again because they still weren't being paid. And then all of a sudden the bills would come in and the scheme would just pay the bills. So, you know, really, who are you blaming for that one? But that's mostly under control because schemes have become quite aware of that. But there's always potential, unless it's an electronic system that's now built in observing that, then there's always that potential it can come back. If I draw a comparison against private health insurance, pretty much using automated payment systems, they're checked against limits automatically, typically live payments, so it's same day, same week, within a few weeks typically. The hospital payment system, they're all electronic. Usually they're on a 28-day contract, so they're guaranteed to be paid within the 28 days. So there's a whole bunch of lessons from other places that the schemes could pick up on. And I use the term schemes loosely. Insurers who are operating in the schemes clearly. So some of those insurers would probably see some of the other ways of doing things, and is there potential to bring those into the payment types that are associated with the schemes as well. Okay. So the hospital example I alluded to, if you're not already doing a fairly bottom-up costing, which is there's national cost data collection that where public hospitals send all their information to Canberra, it gets regurgitated back to the states and the states can do a pricing cut. The schemes have access to that as well, so for their scheme they can actually get the raw data that's being spent within each of the states, work out what that is, the mix against their actual mix, and work out potentially day rates for their schemes. So how many are doing that? I know that quite a few aren't, that probably should be, and that certainly would give them a clearer picture about their true cost base and what they could be paying. But if you're not doing it, if you want to take a more simple approach, there's now the Independent Hospital Pricing Authority, set up a few years ago to try and work out what a reasonable price is nationally, and then there's a relativity model that's laid over that. So length of stay, some Indigenous factors, the kind of care, so for example theatre, high care, acute, subacute, the days, and the injury types, so there's an ICD coding that's attached to that, so what kind of body part was affected, etc. And they can set what's considered reasonable prices for those kinds of services. So the schemes could certainly be adopting that as a basis to get at least in the ballpark for what an appropriate hospital contract might be setting the rates at. Just trying to make sure we're on time. So I mentioned why you may not want to pay. Why you may be willing to pay a bit more for a service or to include services. So there's a reasonable case study that was, I guess, the Association of Physios put into the TAC when they were doing a bit of a review. And the point really that they were trying to make is the current rates that TAC is willing to pay physios is really driving the best physios out of business or away from the scheme. Now, clearly, the scheme has obviously got enough physios doing that work for them, so there's probably a supply and demand. But the question is, and it wouldn't doubt me if TAC have done the research on that, I'm not aware, that they are probably getting the level of care that they're actually asking. But the question still remains, is that really happening across the country as well? So where the fee schedules are a bit lower, and where they're below what they might be getting from commercial people walking off the street, is that really worth their while? Are they giving the full care? Certainly considerations for the schemes. So this second last slide. Working with state health departments, there's lots of different funding mechanisms you can undertake. So bulk billing, bulk funding, block funding, and now the states are looking at activity-based funding. But working with the state health departments is actually, I guess it's trying to swim in quicksand or something a bit like that. They're a large organisation. They're not really focused on you, the scheme. Their block funding's coming from the state and the Commonwealth, and you're actually bonus money into the pool. So they'll be focused on that perspective, but they may not be overly willing to negotiate too much with you around that. You could be working with the providers as well. AMA and the medical colleges and the state employers and associations, The AMA is typically one of the harder organisations to work with as far as if you think you're paying too much, they're not overly easy to work with, and they have withdrawn service from states in the past, and I don't doubt that'll happen in the future as states come under funding pressure and try and control some of that. And another main comparison against private health insurers then is around the kind of national picture that they have. So the health insurers have a national picture, and they work with for-profit hospitals. They also work with the public hospitals, but they're very cost-driven and not really a block funding approach is applied. So I'll wrap up then. So next steps at the moment, this is part of an ongoing research for us and our team, and supporting the medical data collection within the schemes as well, and helping them identify the kinds of things they should be collecting to ensure that they have the strength to be doing some of these negotiations. And I'll wrap up in just looking at some alternatives that could be explored into the future, which is linking to the health insurers around the hospitals and providers. That's certainly an area where I've been focused. Centralised supporting services, so schemes based or across schemes where you're actually getting more people in a more concentrated way who understand what's going on and trying to provide that service out to the schemes and to the insurers. The medical practitioners are clearly the least controlled, and they're really there's a supply demand issue there that I don't think schemes and health insurers certainly haven't solved that one. But probably the main finishing point would be to focus on the edges around some of this, because it'll create some containment, and at least then you've got that contained, even if you can't control what's going on inside it. And then start attempting to measure on an outcomes basis, which then helps to drive some improvement with evidence. So I'll leave it there. Thanks very much for your time.
All right. If questioners would like to make their way to the microphones, one of the microphones on either side. I guess I'll start with the question. So it seems like there's something in here for the schemes. Are you aware of any of the schemes doing benchmarking of their own internally, or if they're not, why not?
So my broad understanding is that Victoria, they have a combined, medical team that works down there, and my understanding is there's been some work done down there, but across the other schemes, I haven't had visibility of that occurring. So I think there's some merit in doing it, and it's certainly an exercise that could be undertaken, at least initially, within the schemes themselves.
All right. Any questions from the floor?
Come on.
After lunch on the second day.
I was wondering if you're going to get that flight. So you talked earlier, you said when you started there was more comprehensive in terms of the payment types. What other sort of payment types have you looked at or are looking at? Do you have any sort of early information on those?
Yeah, so I guess the payment types, we covered the spectrum of the payment types. It's actually the depth of the payments and how many rates and schedules there actually are. So there's pretty much thousands. But some of those you can short-circuit through the Medicare benefit schedule arrangement, and an example there is that also provides a mechanism to do some claims leakage if you're adopting that also, because there's rules around which fee schedule rates can be used with others. And so what we have seen is doctors using those in conflict, which is actually a claims leakage issue. They're not really supposed to be doing that. So if they're doing multiple services, that's actually supposed to be like a grouped service, which there's a discount to. And what we actually see is doctors doing the individual services and billing them in total instead of aggregating them up into a cheaper service block.
Well, Julie's standing at the back of the room, which I assume means that I'm going to wind this up. 2 minutes. Uh-huh. Okay, I have one more question. Was there any other questions from the floor? Before I hog him? No. So the second half of your presentation was mainly about harmonisation. Is that an what you presented an indicator of the hurdles to changing rates?
No, I guess I'd like to think so. So the first half was really a bit of the technical content, but the second half was really, in a way, the technical content's easy. There's lots of holes in it, but really the impediment is the second half of what a quagmire of different things and different motives and loads of different types of providers you're trying to work with and trying to navigate through to get the best outcomes for the scheme. So in my mind, the technical piece is kind of the easy bit, even though there's holes in the data. The hard bit is navigating through all the different people that are involved in the systems and the schemes.
So. All right. Well, I think we'll wrap it up there, unless there's any further questions. No? All right. Well, if everyone would like to join me in thanking Bevan for a thoughtful presentation.
Thanks very much.
Make sure you fill out your...